You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, welcome back, or welcome, as the case may be. It is, we're beginning my fourth hour of talk radio today. It's, right? Yeah. But it's the first hour of what was our show, and starting next week will be Sam Cedar's show. So we will get into that a little bit later. Right now, Maude Barlow is with us, the National Chairperson of the Council of Canadians and Chair of Food and Water Watch, the author of 17 books, including her latest, Blue Future, Protecting Water for People and the Planet Forever. The website is Canadians.org. Maude, welcome to the program.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. I read frankly, alarming article over at EcoWatch that you had written titled, Water Cutoffs in Detroit Are a Violation of Human Rights. What is going on in Detroit?
Well, it's just an awful situation. I mean, people know that the city is in bankruptcy, ordered by the governor, and an emergency manager has been put in charge, so there's really no democratic way to, you know, lodge a complaint or try to change anything. It's like it's coming down from the top, and they're looking at selling off all sorts of things, including the water, the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department, which looks like they're well on their way to privatizing. And it's clear they want to clear the debt, and the debt, they've got large debt from unpaid water bills, lots of them corporate, some of them institutions like schools, and some of them from individuals. But what they're doing is they're going in and they are ruthlessly shutting off the water services to only to the residences, and they are the poorest of the poor. They're doing something between 1,500 and 3,000 a week now.
Wow.
They're looking to do at least 120,000 cutoffs by the end of the summer. They're brutal. I mean, they don't even let you fill up a bathtub or fill up your sinks or pots or anything. When they arrive, they turn it off. And we're talking about families with old people, families with children, unable to flush toilets, unable to turn on their water. And it is a clear violation of the human right to water, which was recognized by the United Nations in 2010.
But is not binding on the United States, unfortunately, around the city of Detroit.
Well, the United States voted for it, you'll be glad to know. Not at the General Assembly, which was the first vote, but the United States was newly on the Human Rights Council, and when the Human Rights Council adopted a similar resolution, the United States agreed.
No, I understand, but these are resolutions, not treaties.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's not like a trade agreement where, you know, if they mean it, they give it teeth, and they only mean the trade agreement. But really, in the international forum, when a new right is recognized, there are obligations on governments, and it is just appalling that in this day and age, poor people who cannot pay their bills are having their water turned off. And it's a lesson for us here in the global north that it's not just poor countries of the global south anymore. You're going to see more and more of this as we privatize our public spaces, as the price of these utilities go up, and as people get poorer and poorer while some people get richer and richer. We're going to see this more Detroit in our future.
It's the third worldization of the United States of America, and it's been going on since the Reagan Revolution. And getting more and more aggressive. So this is Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. I mean, this is just incredible. Detroit is basically being sold off. Let me see if I understand this correctly. They want to privatize. They want to sell the water system to some, presumably even foreign corporation. I think the largest company in the world that owns water systems around the world is a French corporation, isn't it?
There are two of them, Suez and Veolia, and you can be sure that one of them will be involved in this.
Yeah, okay. So they want to sell the water system of Detroit to some other country so that even the profits end up overseas. And in order to do that, to increase its value and thus the price that they'll get from it, so that the Governor Rick Snyder and his cronies in the Michigan legislature can say, oh, look at all the money we got. We can cut taxes on rich people even more for a year or two. In order to increase the price of the water system, they're trying to offload the debt of it so it looks more profitable. And to offload the debt, they have to cut out of the system the people who are in debt who have not been paying their bills. Do I have that right?
You have that right, and it's really important to note that it's a money-making operation. I mean, you know, any private company is going to be happy to have this huge water service. So the debt, yes, is there, but they also make money every year. So it's, you know, we, I don't want to.
Even in the face of people not being able to pay their bills.
Oh, yeah. And as I say, there are a lot of corporate debts, too. As you know, they're not going after the golf courses that haven't paid their
Why not?
Utilities. Well, you tell me. I mean, this is it. But look, I want to say this, Tom, because it's really important. We've seen over a million people leave Detroit, the inner city of Detroit. And so money has left, business has left, wealth has left, people who have a certain level of income have left. And what it's done, they didn't have enough people paying enough money for the water services. In other words, they needed to increase the rates, and they increased the rates 120% in 10 years. So who were left behind were the poorest people, in the community, mostly African Americans, seniors, single mothers, and they cannot afford to pay these incredibly raised rates. The other thing they did was that to cut costs a few years ago, they stopped sending bills, just said, well, you know, come in and pay the bills when you think they're due, sort of thing. Then they put in these smart meters, and the bills went backwards. They counted backwards, sometimes to residents who'd owned the house or were in the house before. So suddenly people were having bills of $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, unable to pay. They are cutting the water off to anybody who owes more than $150. And we are talking about a community where with almost 40% poverty rate and very high unemployment. And these are people who are living on, you know, a fifth of the world's surface water. I mean, they're right on the Great Lakes, right on that basin. How do you square the fact that agribusiness and big bottled water companies and all the golf courses and everybody can get all the water they want, often subsidized, and yet the people are taking it in the neck? This is an absolute violation of the human right to water, and something that must go, I think, should go to the highest level in the United States. I think that President Obama should step in. I think if these were white middle-class people getting their water turned off and their kids taken away, by the way, that's happening too, because there are no working utilities now in these communities, that I think there would be an outcry all over the United States. But because they're poor and African-American and there's this feeling, well, Detroit's finished, you know, let it burn to death, you know, burn down or whatever, I don't think people are paying that kind of attention. And this is the worst. I mean, this is a form of racism. Let's say it out loud. And I think it needs to be dealt with. I visited the community just last week. I met with people who've had their water cut off. There are protests now. They're growing. You're going to be hearing more about this. This is not going to go away. This issue must go before the American people.
Wow. Wow. We have just a minute left. What do you see, Maud? What do you see as the best thing that somebody who is listening or watching right now can do?
They can speak to everybody they know. They can get to the media and write letters to the editor so that this information gets out. They can go to our website, Canadians.org, or Food and Water Watch, which is foodandwaterwatch.org, which is our sister group in the United States, and get information and talk to their Congress people, write to the president. We need, especially, and of course, if they live in that state, if they live in Michigan, to write to the governor, because there's no way to, I mean, write to the mayor. The mayor agrees with not with what's happening, with what I'm saying, but he.
Right.
You know,
the mayor has no power anymore. It's been given to Kevin
no
Ott, I think his name is, the emergency manager.
Kevin Orr.
That's right.
But you can write to Kevin Orr till you're blue in the face. The fact is that the man's got one man.
Well, he's a corporate lawyer.
That's it. I mean, so please do get involved. Don't think this is somebody else's issue, because you know what, Tom? This is coming to other cities if we don't stop it.
There you go. Okay. Maud Barlow, National Chairperson of the Council of Canadians and Chair of Food and Water Watch. Food and Water Watch. What's the website for Food and Water Watch?
Foodandwaterwatch.org.
That's easy enough. Thank you very much, Maud.
My entire pleasure, Tom. Talk again.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Just another example of the rob, rape, and pillage strategy of these neocons here in the United States. It's amazing. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Patrick in Park City, Utah. Hey, Patrick, what's on your mind today? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV.
So, actually, Tom, I just had to follow up with the amazing interview, and I'm sorry to just to switch gears on you here, but yesterday with William Black, and I have just a quick question to get your perspective.
Sure.
After everything you heard yesterday in context to the crash of 2016. I recalled from a previous show that you had thought that it was going to take a sort of, you know, cataclysmic, if you will, crash for America to wake up to be able to kind of come to the understanding of everything that you've been putting out there for some time. And I wonder if your perspective at all has changed, because it seemed like there was a couple of moments yesterday with Mr. Black that even somewhat surprised you by the level of absolute insanity by way of the multi-trillion-dollar fraud that the financialization of this country has gotten away with, and what it actually all means in context to the numbers that have vetted out, you know, between the billionaires, the have-nots, yada, yada, yada. I'm just curious if it at all changed your perspective, or do you still think that it's going to take the ultimate crash?
I still think I still think it's going to take the crash. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to say, it just seems to me like if more people heard from Black and had it more in context and it more easily...
But see, they're not going to, Patrick, because the people who are on the board of directors of the big media companies are also on the board of directors of the big banks.
Right. And the energy companies, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, go to theyrule.net. It's a website that allows you to pull up a company and another company and just see how they interconnect with regard to their boards of directors. The 100 largest companies in America, in my book Unequal Protection, I did a round robin where I took the 100 largest companies in America, and you can connect one to the next all the way, and it makes a complete circle where, you know, the company A, you know, has Joe Blow on his board, and Joe Blow happens to be on company B's board also. Company B has Sam Johnson on his board, who happens to be on company C's board. Company C, you know, and you can literally loop all 100 companies just by having, you know, multiple board members. It's become, you know, a profession in America to be a professional board member. It's and a lot of these guys are former members of Congress, particularly former senators, by the way. But and also a lot of them are retired CEOs.
And then if you connect the dots to that, to the Justice Department, of course, that's why you figure there's no one in jail.
No.
It's unbelievable, Tom. Thank you for everything you do, man.
Yeah. Thank you, Patrick. Good to hear from you, and I appreciate it. And in fact, let me just go off on this a little bit, if I may, particularly given that I have a little less than a minute. It wouldn't be fair to a caller to bring him in. We have a crisis of governance in the United States. We have a crisis of governance, of government governance. We have a crisis of governance in as much as, you know, we, the people of the United States, are no longer in charge of our own destiny. We have a crisis of governance in the, you know, the neocons and the billionaires taking over our political systems and all these things. We also have a crisis of corporate governance. The corporations in the United States are now being run, by and large, in my opinion, by sociopaths rather than by rational business people. And the reason for this is because back in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan changed the rules of compensation so that CEOs could be compensated with stock options in addition to their pay. And so instead of having their loyalty to the institution of the company, to the employees, to the customers, and to the community, like workers or like CEOs used to have, as well as the stockholders, now they are loyal exclusively to the stockholders. And with this single-minded focusness on jacking up the stock price, they're screwing us all. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Amazing. I think about this for a minute. What should be in the public domain? What should we, the people, collectively own? If not our water. I mean, you can live for maybe 5 minutes, maybe at the most 10 minutes without air. You can live for weeks without food. And you can't live more than, I think it's 6 or 7 days without water. I think after about a week, people start, you know, their kidneys start crashing and they start dying of dehydration and kidney failure. Water is like, it's right up there with air and food. Now, I'm not suggesting that our food is entirely the commons, but it interacts with the commons, and that's why we have food inspectors like the USDA It's why we have, I mean, there's just this whole variety of people whose job is to make sure that our food supply is safe, that our food is healthy, that you know, we have access to reasonable amounts of food. I mean, just some pretty straightforward stuff. But when you think about the concept of the commons, you know, why did we start this country in the first place? Why did we, the people, come together and write a constitution and fight a war and start a country? We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense and promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States of America. The purpose of government is to protect the commons. The big debate now that is happening in Congress, and you're seeing, here's the tip of the spear, John Boehner coming out day before yesterday and saying, you know, 20 years ago, I said we should privatize the VA. I think I'm ready to have that conversation again. Privatizing the medical services for our military. We need a serious, honest, intelligent discussion in this country about the commons, about our air. To what extent is the air our commons? To what extent should the Koch brothers be allowed to simply pollute it with their paper mills and their refineries versus should we, the people, say, no, you know, there are limits on how much pollution we are willing to accept from you. We realize you can't take it back to zero, but maybe you can compensate us for the damage you're doing. Well, they're not. I mean, no, we don't see that happening right now. And, of course, it's not just the Koch brothers. I mean, oil industry, paper industry. But with our air, with our water, with electricity, I mean, typically what we have defined as the commons have been two categories of things. Number one, the stuff that we all collectively own. We collectively own the government of the United States. It is the commons. The means by which we administer the commons of the government is through our vote. So this is the most important part of the commons, the vote. We've already privatized that. That was insane and needs to be reversed. You have a private corporation now counting your vote and telling you how you voted. That should be done away with. That is something that happened. It began in the late 1990s, and it has now basically taken over the entire United States. Since the Help America Vote Act was passed, which passed out billions of dollars to the states to bring private for-profit corporations in to count the votes. So let's make our vote part of the commons again. The means by which we administer the rest of the commons. But then the rest of the commons, what is the rest of the commons? We have historically agreed that the things that we collectively own are the commons, our air, our national parks, our public roads, the ways that we protect ourselves, our army, our police departments, our fire departments, these are all parts of the commons. And then we took a step beyond that and we said, you know, and anything that's a natural monopoly, because a monopoly cannot really operate in a capitalist environment. There's no competition with a monopoly. So it doesn't make sense to allow for-profit corporations to own a natural monopoly. So what's a natural monopoly? Natural monopoly is something where there's really only one source of it. How many water companies are you going to have deliver water to your house? How many pipes do you have coming into your house? 2, 3, 4, 5? You can pick which water company you want to buy from? No. There's one water company. So privatizing the water is insane. Because it's a natural monopoly, which means that the water company is going to be able to charge you whatever they damn well please. And they will, by the way. More than 3/4 of the water in the United States is owned by municipalities and communities, and only about a quarter of it is privately owned. Before Reagan, it was a tiny fraction. It was a hundredth or thereabouts. Electricity. More than half of the electricity produced in the United States. Again, another natural monopoly. You got one power company coming into your house. Shouldn't this be part of the commons? Now that we get our television and our internet through a single piece of wire coming into our house, shouldn't that become part of the commons? Or at least shouldn't those companies be regulated as common carriers? Phone companies are regulated as common carriers. In other words, part of the commons. Internet companies should be too. That would guarantee net neutrality. The FCC could do this tomorrow morning. We need to lean on Tom Wheeler about that. Our public schools, part of the commons. But you've got these cons who are licking their chops because the commons are the places where you can make great profit and you never have to worry about competition.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And that was Governor Rick Snyder's whole plan, this Republican governor of Michigan, when he threw Detroit into the hands of the emergency manager and said, sell off the commons. And welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. No, I don't think so. Not, it can't, no, really. Seriously? John in Villa Park, Illinois. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I was just driving by Lake Michigan in Chicago when I heard the discussion about the water in Detroit.
Yeah, the fifth largest source of fresh water in the world.
The most valuable thing in the world, as far as I'm concerned.
Yep.
And the reason I called was twofold. I actually have a song called Let's Privatize the Air, which is sort of a Jonathan Swift modest proposal of what the free market capitalists will do logically with all of the things that we need to live, from the air, the water, to the sun, and everything else. And it seems to me that they've gotten to the point where they are interested in making it happen. So when they are poisoning water with the idea that they can sell it back to you cleaned up. Now, I know that's a stretch. There are not a cabal of people who are doing that on purpose. But if I can imagine it, I'm pretty sure, you know, it's been considered that the water is more valuable polluted because then they can clean it up and sell it back to you.
So are you talking about like the refineries
in northern Indiana and the fracking that's going on over the aquifer? I just heard about a nuclear waste area on the Great Lakes in Canada. They were talking about putting about 20 miles inland. There seems to be an almost willful effort to pollute.
Well, this is the bizarre thing about GDP and measuring an economy. As you know, Robert Kennedy gave this famous speech years ago. We've got the clip of it around here someplace, and he basically said, you know, GDP is no way to measure the quality of life in a nation. Gross domestic product. It was called GNP back then. You got the clip? And in fact, turn straight ahead to here's what Robert Kennedy had to say about the stupid, and it speaks directly to what you're talking about, John, because basically what these guys are doing is saying, oh, here's an opportunity for economic churn. And Bobby Kennedy is saying, this is when he was running for president back in the 60s, he's saying, no, just churning the economy for churning the economy includes a lot of evil stuff. Here he is.
Too much and for too long, we seem to have surrendered personal excellence and community value in the mere accumulation of material things. Our gross national product now is over $800 billion a year. But that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that, that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwood and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm, and it counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities. It counts Whitman's rifle and Speck knife, and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.
There you go. So, John...
Wonderful. That was wonderful.
Yeah. And it really speaks to what you're talking about, because this, you know, Kennedy was pointing out, we need a different value system in America. We need to change our fundamental values from, can I make a buck off it, to, is it the best thing for society? If it is, and I can make a buck off it, then cool. If it's going to hurt society, you're going to make a buck off it, then we need to ring fence it. We need to restrain it. John, thank you for the call, and thanks for giving me an opportunity to play that clip. I appreciate it. Ed, in Azle, Texas. I'm sorry, Ed. What's up?
Well, I heard you say something about the government, and
I do that frequently, Ed.
I'm watching your show right now.
Uh-huh. What did I say about the government this time?
Trying to be the leg. Well, the government is there to regulate commerce. They're not there for the good of the people. And
did I say that?
You know. No, you said the government is there to protect the people.
To promote the general welfare. Actually, what I was reading was the preamble to the Constitution of the United States, which says that we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, run our court system, ensure domestic tranquility, police, fire, provide for the common defense, the army, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Also in Article 1, Section 8, which everybody loves to list as the powers granted to Congress, the enumerated powers, it starts out by saying, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and the general welfare of the United States. And that part ends with, and Congress can make all laws which may be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or any government or officer thereof. In other words, Congress can do pretty much anything as long as it falls into the realm of the general welfare of the United States. That's simply reading to you the exact unedited, without commentary, words of the framers of the Constitution of the United States, Ed.
But that is not the truth.
Well,
exactly what's going on right now.
Okay, what's going on right now?
Well, first, the Constitution. How could you apply it to you? You're not signatory to that. And the United States is a corporation of 50 states. Well, it could be more by now, but it's there to regulate interstate commerce.
Well, the regulation of interstate commerce is one of the specific things are mentioned in Article 1, Section 8. And, you know, it's been used in a variety of ways, and including ways that have made people crazy, like, you know, here it is. Number three, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and the Indian tribes. Yeah, Article 1, Section 8, sentence 3. What's wrong with regulating commerce among the several states and with foreign nations and Indian nations?
Well, the commerce, this word that came out of commerce, derived from word commerce, is crime.
No, it's not.
There's no commerce, there's no crime.
No, crime and commerce have completely different root meanings, and they're completely different words.
Well, without commerce, there's no crime.
Why would that be?
What I'm saying is they really got you where they want you to be. You have to bring the truth to the people.
Who's they, Ed?
The, the truth is the one that will set you free.
Okay, that, you know, I've heard that cliche before. Who is the they who's got me?
Well, the government. Like you say, you're a very influential person. A lot of people listening to you.
So, and who has the, so I'm here as a tool of the government in your mind. So if that's the case, who controls the government? Isn't it you and me at the ballot box?
Well, like any other corporations, there are owners.
The United States government has owners. Aren't the owners the citizens of the United States? Isn't the first three words of the Constitution, we the people?
That's what we believe, but that's not.
But that's not the case. Okay, Ed, you have a I get it. You have a worldview that I don't share or understand, and I, you know, I respect your right to that worldview, but I can't really continue the conversation because I'm not sure what you're talking about. Catherine in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hi, I was going to call in about Michigan, and I was glad she did, but she left out a lot, and it's extremely upsetting. First of all, you can go to thevoiceofdetroit.net and read the article. First of all, when they shut water off, Department of Social Services comes in and takes the children away.
Yeah, she mentioned that.
Okay. Secondly, they are having mass concentration camp imprisonments at the Mount Road State Facility. There was a woman who was protesting what was happening. The guy said he was just a contractor. I find it very interesting. The contractor is with the Home Rich Wrecking Company. And they have a 730-day contract. They're going to do 70,000 residents. You know, there's no show, no order, no nothing. They just come over and they're starting to turn it off. She asked him what he was doing. He said he didn't have any paperwork. She went over to his car. She thought he was going to put something on the computer. And what he did was he took off, and he actually hit her with the car.
Whoa.
His red gallon jug that he would put gasoline in fell off. She calls the police. They accuse her of stealing city property because that gasoline jug is there, and they take her off.
Amazing. Catherine, we're out of time here, so once again, where's the website where everybody can read this?
Voiceofdetroit.net. You really have to read
it. Okay, voiceofdetroit.net. Thank you, Catherine, for that. You know, what we're seeing, frankly, I think what we're seeing is the clearing of Detroit for some giant corporate project.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, Henry Ford was no fool. Detroit is perfectly situated for any kind of major commercial or industrial effort. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Where are we? On one. Yes. Okay. Thank you. Hey, Steve, in Morrison, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up, Steve?
Well, my idea is simple. If they would start getting these groups together that are all these poor people that represent them and that, and start going to foreign countries for aid. I mean, we give money to every country in the world, so now maybe they could. I mean, how would these people feel if they started paying their bills with euros and yen and all kinds of foreign money started? It's coming in anyway. So
yeah.
It's time these people said, hey, we're going to get it first.
When Hugo Chavez was alive, Citgo, the Citgo gas stations are actually owned by the Venezuelan National Oil Company. And when Hugo Chavez was alive, they had a very aggressive and successful program in the American Northeast during the winters where poor people who could demonstrate that they could not afford heating oil got free heating oil from Venezuela, delivered, you know, via Citgo, and they ran ads on it on TV. I you know, up in Vermont, I remember seeing the ads, and you know, just saying, here's what we're doing in your community. And I thought, you know, how sad is it that America has reached the point where a third world nation, you know, Venezuela. I mean, they're not even part of the OECD. I don't think they're considered a fully developed industrialized nation. Is giving us welfare, you know, it's like, but yeah, it's a real genuine tragedy, Steve. Steve, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Jerry in Meshuppin, Pennsylvania. Am I saying that right, Jerry?
Good afternoon, Tom. What a pleasure to get through to you.
Well, thank you.
Our water was condemned up here years ago over the fracking and drilling.
Oh, really?
And there has been no relief for us. It's sue the gas and oil.
So how do you get water? Yeah, Jerry.
We've had to have it hauled. We've brought it in ourselves for years. We're still bathing in this contaminated water. This should have been sealed years ago, like Franklin Township. But you guys would have smelled us all over the world by now.
Wow.
The issue that has come up with the last investigation, the state up here and the federal agencies about this water, it has acetone, uranium, barium. The issue is we had no water. Other people have buffaloes at their home that they had to build insulated heating buildings around, but you still cannot drink that water.
What's a buffalo?
A water buffalo is where they haul water in. It's a big plastic tank to fill up with water for your bathing and flushing your toilet. But you still have to haul in all your drinking and cooking water.
Right.
Ours is so full of mercury that in boiling it in the pressure canner, it actually made mercury balls on top of the canner and plugged it up.
Really?
So we've had to resort to something we never wanted to do, and we brought in a drinkable air machine. I was listening to you. My fear is the next thing they're going to say, we can't even harvest this air to make our water for our home. Because where I live, the owner of the land is actually looking to put a whole house system in.
So the water that you're drinking now is basically the condensate from a dehumidifier.
Yes, and it
you're pulling it out of the air.
Yep, and it.
And if the air's polluted, that water's polluted too. By the way, you know that.
Well, it goes through this whole ionizing machine.
I see.
Actually, they're built here in America.
That's incredible.
It's purified and everything.
That's incredible. Jerry, an amazing story. Thank you for calling and sharing it with us. That's incredible. Thank you so much. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. Kai Newkirk on the line with us, the founder of 99RISE, the website 99RISE.org, also founded MarchForDemocracy.org. Hey, Kai, what's up?
Hey there, Tom. Good to be back with you. We're marching here down the highway right now.
What highway? Where?
Heading out of Bakersfield.
California?
We've come about 150 miles. We're headed to North Bakersfield today. Day 13. Spirits are strong.
Bakersfield, California, I assume?
That's right.
Okay. And you are, for people who may not have heard you the last time you were on the program, let's reboot this whole thing. You are marching from and to over a period of and for the purpose of fill in the blanks.
That's right. We're marching from L.A. to Sacramento over 480 miles over 37 days. We're marching to end corruption and save democracy. We want California's leaders to publicly acknowledge that the system is corrupt and to take immediate action to end it and get big money out of politics once and for all.
By doing what?
Well, there's three steps we want them to take. The first, it's a call for a federal Article 5 constitutional convention that would propose a 28th Amendment to clarify that money is not speech, that corporations are not people, and that Congress can regulate campaign spending. This is what's going to help us to get to the root of this problem and change it for our whole country and abolish the big money corruption of our democracy. There's two other steps that they need to take. They need to give California's voters the opportunity to vote on the November ballot on a constitutional amendment. And third, they need to pass the Disclose Act, which would make the top three funders for any political act prominently visible so people can start to see the influence that these folks are having.
Yeah, yeah, this is all good stuff. And so, Kai, you're marching, you're going along, your spirits are good, you're getting good feedback from the people along the way?
Yeah, you know, I tell you, it's tough. You know, we're doing a lot of miles per day. We're going over the mountains through the desert. People have blisters, people get sick. But our spirits are really buoyed by the support of folks in the communities that we go through on Lancaster and Bakersfield. People have come out and let us know that they stand with us. They've given us food, shelter, water, come to events, come to talk to assembly members and state senators with us. And that gives us strength to know that all the folks out there, not just in California, but in the country, who believe in political equality, one person, one vote, we're marching to inspire them to take action. So when people take time out of their days to come out, support us, open up their homes to us, feed us, it gives us strength to keep on marching.
That is marvelous. Kai Newkirk, he's the founder of 99RISE. The website is 99RISE.org, 99RISE.org, and MarchForDemocracy.org. And Kai, thanks so much for being with us today and for giving us the update.
Thank you, Tom. If you got a second, I wanted to let all the marchers have a moment to tell you who we're returning power to.
Sure.
We the people, that's right. Everybody, thank you for your support on this march. Join us when we get to Sacramento, Sunday, June 22nd.
Okay. Sounds like a plan. Kai, thanks so much. And please give our very best to all the marchers, and we wish you all the very, very, very best. And the best of luck on that thing. Brian in Elmhurst, Illinois. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, getting back to your discussion of CEO compensation. First, you had cited Warren Buffett as someone who supports it. Actually, he does not. He supports stock grants themselves because that way the executives have an incentive to think more in the long term. If it's an option, it's just a, you know, they can take wild chances and just try and win. But what I really wanted to say is what people need to understand is the way the CEO compensation is done today is the CEO or someone, you know, working for him or her will retain a consultant who makes a report to the board of directors to determine what the CEO pay is. But that's a conflict of interest because the consultant wants to get more business, and the way to get more business is just giving higher and higher numbers for CEO compensation. So
right.
It's not like the labor market. It's completely different.
No, it's a cartel, basically. And a lot of CEOs serve on the compensation boards of other CEOs.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a totally corrupt system. And then within that totally corrupt system, you have the problem that the business model of America has been corrupted. You're right about Warren Buffett. I did not think that I was asserting that he had any particular position on this. I think we should just go back to the way it was pre-Reagan and just say stock is not a viable form of compensation. If executives want to buy stock, they can buy it on the New York Stock Exchange. But, Brian, thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Great to hear.
Sure. Real quickly, you were implying that Warren Buffett wanted the options because all he cared about was the stock price. But his position is when you give the executives options, they're going to take greater risk because they have no downside. And in the long term, it actually hurts a long-term investor like Warren Buffett.
Right. I agree. And I did not know that I had invoked Warren Buffett's name at all in that context. And if I did, maybe it was a throwaway line or something. But you're absolutely right. And Warren Buffett is not the bad guy in this thing. And thanks a lot for the call. David in Shelter Cove, California. You know why the stars are upside down on the Republicans logo?
Well, I have a slight theory.
Okay.
I think that it might have, you've asked many Republicans and they don't know. They never noticed it.
Yeah.
Maybe they just don't care and it was an error. And now if it would have been the dollar signs and they were backwards, they would have noticed right away.
Yeah. You know, the one thing that I have learned, and I've just learned this in the last month or two, and I haven't been able to independently verify it, but I've seen it in two different sources, is that the company, the ad agency that the RNC hired in 2000 to redesign their logo was called Pentagram Productions or something like that. It has the name Pentagram in their company name.
Mm-hmm.
And an upside-down five-pointed star is a pentagram. You know, the satanic star is called the pentagram. And so I'm wondering if this company, as like just the ultimate practical joke, or even the ultimate screw you to the Republican Party, imposed their own logo on the Republican Party, and the Republicans just have yet to have figured it out.
Yeah, you know, and the devil is in the details.
Perfect. Perfect. Well said. David, thank you very much for the call. For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, just check out the Republican logo. You'll see it on TV from time to time. In 2000, the Republicans flipped the three stars on top of the elephant upside down. So instead of being the five-pointed star like on the flag, which is Michelangelo's man, you know, head, arms, legs, now it's upside down. It is the satanic goat with the two horns at the top, the two big ears at the side, and the chinny chin chin on the bottom. Why did the Republicans make their logo the symbol of Satan? I've been asking this question of Republicans ever since 2000. I've literally asked hundreds of them, elected officials, Republican officials, the head of the RNC on two different occasions. None of them have ever been able to tell me why this has happened.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. You know, every country thinks of themselves as exceptional. And every country is in their own way. And American exceptionalism, that phrase has meant a lot of things over the years. I mean, we've used it in the past to justify bullying around the world. We've used it to justify invading countries like Iraq that were largely minding their own business. We've used it for noble purposes like ending slavery and enfranchising women. Exceptionalism has often led to bad behavior, as we saw in the years leading up to World War II. Yet in America, like in pretty much every other country, it's a political necessity to patriotically assert the uniqueness of one's country and love of one's country. This can be a healthy thing, unless it's used to assert both uniqueness and superiority. Then it turns toxic. There's a meaningful parallel here with tribalism and racism. To say I'm of Turkish or Norwegian or African ancestry and proud of it is an entirely different thing from saying that one's ancestry makes one superior to other people, and then to go out and assert that supposed superiority by doing things like perpetrating job or housing discrimination. Awareness or even pride are different from oppression or assertion of power over others. President Obama yesterday redefined, and this was, you know, in his speech, and I think it was largely ignored or missed by most Americans, he largely redefined American exceptionalism in a way that essentially recalibrated it away from the Bush definition. He said, "I believe in American exceptionalism with every fiber of my being, but what makes us exceptional is not our ability to flout international norms and the rule of law." You will recall, I editorially comment here in the middle of my Obama quote, Bush was a master at ignoring international norms and the rule of law. Anyhow, back to Obama. It's our willingness to affirm them through our actions. That's why, President Obama said, "I will continue to push to close Gitmo because American values and legal traditions don't permit the indefinite detention of people beyond our borders." He goes on to say, "That's why we are putting in place new restrictions on how America collects and uses intelligence." Oh, he's replying to Edward Snowden. Excuse me. "Because we will have fewer partners and be less effective if a perception takes hold that we are conducting surveillance against ordinary citizens. America does not simply stand for stability or the absence of conflict, no matter what the price. We stand for the more lasting peace that can only come through opportunity and freedom for people everywhere." While most Americans probably didn't notice this nuanced shift in the president's definition of American exceptionalism, I think it's worth noting. You know, while politics demands that he continue to use the word or the phrase, he's shifting its meaning to one that's more rational and more useful. Can you imagine what American exceptionalism might mean today if John McCain, for example, had been elected president? Iran would be a smoldering rubble. We'd have 100,000 troops in Syria and God knows where else. Saying that we're exceptional because we actually follow international law and advocate peace is to say that all countries can fit that definition and to set a good example for the world. Now, if President Obama would take it all away and follow the rule of international law to not kill civilians in foreign lands with drones, he might be actually taken more seriously. And if Republicans would get with the program and let the president use federal money to close Gitmo, we might begin to meet this new definition of exceptionalism that's actually a healthy and useful one. We might rejoin the family of nations around the world that actually embrace peace and the rule of law. And wouldn't that be an amazing thing? Mark in Janesville, Wisconsin, listening on WCPT. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, I'm a longtime listener. Hey, I'm glad you're on the radio. I listened to a fellow that follows up right after you, Norman Goldman. He talked extensively about the radios and all the Republicans basically own all the big media outlets, radios, and I'm glad you're hanging in there.
They don't own WCPT, and so we're here. They own some of the stations that we're on. But anyway, let's not get into that. What's up, Mark?
Yeah. Hey, I was going to make a comment. I got everything backwards. I read the crash 2016 and then the reboot and then screwed. I couldn't agree with all of them more. I wish they'd have all juniors and seniors in high school read your books.
Thank you. Rebooting the American Dream, by the way, is available online free over at truthout.org. That book.
Actually, I got them at our public library.
Oh, great.
They carry them all. They're great.
Good on you.
Our county here. And but they're wonderful books. I guess one comment I was going to make, I kind of sensed it a little bit in your book, some dissatisfaction with Obama. He doesn't seem to take it. He's no Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And, I just wonder, do you think that's because of the immense pressure, because some of the right and the Mark Levins and the Rush Limbaughs, and then the Republican, Tea Partiers in the Congress, why he hasn't went farther?
I'm not sure. Certainly the media marketplace is very different now than it was in the 1930s. Other voices can be much louder than the president's. Also, you didn't have the media being so heavily influenced by right-wing billionaires, although they had their influence. I mean, they almost did a coup against him. But I think that the biggest difference between I've been very pleased by a lot of the things that Obama did and very disappointed in what I thought were a few missed opportunities. But and principally his opportunity to call out the Republicans. But he's in a unique position in some regards in that, number one, when FDR came into office, he was elected in November of 1932. The great crash happened in October of 29. And so from 29 to 32, for 3 years, people experienced the horrors of Republican economic policies. And, they clearly understood that the Roaring Twenties had been phony. They'd been a bubble. They'd been created by Harding's so-called prosperity, his less government in business, less business, more business in government, his tax cuts for the rich. Warren Harding, when he came into office, dropped the top tax rate from 91% down to 25%. It was like super instant Reaganomics, deregulated the banks, deregulated the stock market, just the whole thing. Harding did that in 21, and it led right to the crash of 29. And it took Americans 3 years to fully digest it, but pretty much nobody was disputing the fact that it was Republican economic policies that created the Great Depression. And so when FDR was elected, not only did he have a huge mandate, but he had a supermajority in both the House and Senate, so he could pretty much do whatever he wanted. The only thing that was blocking him was the Supreme Court. And eventually he took care of them in 1937 by threatening to have Congress change the nature of the court, which is a power provided to Congress in Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. So there was which is very different from when Barack Obama came into office. When he came into office, we'd only been in trouble for a few months, and most Americans didn't realize that we were sliding into something as bad or perhaps worse than 1929. And, there was a sense of concern, but the pain hadn't really bit hard. It hadn't really set in. And then Obama became president, and he got the stimulus passed and got long-term unemployment extended. And so the pain wasn't as bad. And so he has not had the mandate that FDR had. So to expect him to be FDR, I think, is unrealistic. So those are my thoughts on it, Mark. And that's why I think, you know, it's going to take a great crash and a couple of years of pain before anybody really gets it. Thanks a lot.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, Sam Cedar's going to drop by and say hi. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour. And Jeff watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network in New Lisbon, Wisconsin. You are on the air. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for the time. I appreciate it. Regarding GNP, now, say something like Guybolt, where the CEO promised to give the votes to Bush in 2004.
Well,
is that considered a fraction of the GNP? And then beyond that, if I could, I want to suggest that just like India, I believe, has a week's worth of voting.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, why not 8 days of the week? Let's make it a Beatles song and make it Tuesday to Thursday.
That's a good idea, Jeff. And just, you know, for the record on the Diebold thing, Wally O'Dell, the president of Diebold, who lived in and was headquartered in Ohio, wrote a fundraising letter for the Ohio Republicans, the state Republicans, in which he promised to do everything he could to deliver the state of Ohio for George Bush. I have problems with the Diebold machines. I think privatizing our vote was a crime against democracy. I do believe that there were machines that were hacked, particularly down in Alabama in the 2002 election that involved Don Siegelman. I think it was pretty obvious, pretty blatant. And I think that's the reason why they've got him in prison right now, because he called him out on it. And Karl Rove was involved in it. Those are my opinions, and I stand by them, and I always have. The red shift happened. There was no blue shift. So, you know, I have a real problem with these. But I don't think that Wally O'Dell was committing or confessing to a crime when he wrote that letter, just for the record. But yeah, so 8 days a week, great suggestion. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Seth in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Seth, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Great. What's on your mind?
First of all, I wanted to talk a little bit about the upside-down pentacles.
Yeah, how the Republicans turned the stars upside down on their logo back in 2000. Sure. Pentagrams.
Yeah. I think, I don't know about this, but the pentacle comes from the European witchcraft tradition.
And among others.
The upside-down. Right. And I think that the pentacle is from the Greek, the pagan god Pan. So the god Pan is the upside-down pentacle. You see his beard and his horns and that.
Yeah, it's the goat's head. It's the two horns at the top, the chinny-chin-chin on the bottom, and the ears on the two sides. And that's now
right.
What's on the top of the elephant on the GOP logo.
Right, and Pan is not Satan.
No, Pan was the trickster. Pan was like Coyote in Native American traditions.
Yeah, I think the Christians co-opted it as Satan later on.
Oh, the Christians co-opted pretty much everything out of paganism and called it satanic.
Right.
Or
right.
Applied it. I mean, you know, the Yule log, the Christmas tree, they either stole it or they condemned it, one or the other, but they never acknowledged it.
That's right. So I'm not sure about that. It's just an idea. So
are you suggesting that the reason the Republicans flipped the stars on their logo upside down in 2000 when George Bush became their candidate was because they had decided that they were now the tricksters?
Well, they are into magic. They, when you go up the ladder of the Freemasons, they're into the arcane art.
Serious black magic, it seems. Very interesting stuff. Seth, thanks for the theory. Thanks for the call. We'll be back. Sam Cedar's going to be with us in just a second. Stick around. Back on two. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day. Well, actually, this week, 6 hours a day, 5 days a week. Sam Cedar is on the line with us, the host of the Majority Report, co-host of Ring of Fire Radio, the website majority.fm, and ringoffireradio.com, of course. Sam, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be back.
It is. It is so nice to hear your voice again. And I want to let our listeners know, we're going through a bit of a transition, we being you and me personally and the radio industry as a whole, or at least the progressive end of the radio industry, in that my show is officially, this week, I guess, officially moved to the noon to three day part Eastern time, and which opens up 3 to 6, and there was nobody in that day part, and you are starting a show in the 3 to 6 day part. For our viewers on Free Speech TV, for the next 2 weeks, you will be seeing my show time delayed, and then we will start. You will start seeing us live at noon rather than at 3. And but for all our listeners on radio and our various radio stations, you know, we're already live noon to 3. So tell us about your plans for 3 to 6, Sam.
Well, we are. I'm going to be talking into the microphone, and we're still figuring out. You know, the show is going to be. Ring of Fire with Sam Cedar. We're still going to be doing the Ring of Fire on the weekends. The weekday show will obviously be a little bit different because, you know, we're doing it on a daily basis. And, we're working out all the details, but one way or another, by hook or by crook, we will figure it out, and we'll be live on Monday at 3 p.m. Eastern. And, you know, next week promises to be a pretty interesting week. You know, we've got, primaries going on across the country that involve a lot of progressive candidates. We also have, you know, some news in New York State, which I think has a lot of implications for, frankly, the Democratic Party, as a whole. And, that involves, you know, the question as to whether or not there's going to be some independent challenge to Andrew Cuomo here in New York State.
Right, who has demonstrated to be not just a new Democrat like Bill Clinton, but far to the right, in my opinion. I mean, you live in New York State. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Andrew Cuomo. He's been a profound disappointment to me.
I mean, he's been a profound disappointment. You got to remember, he did come in, though, saying that he was going to put it to unions, and he certainly met that promise. He also said back when he was elected that he was going to push campaign finance laws. He completely abandoned that. He's also been pushing, and, you know, and I agree with you, you know, Bill Clinton obviously came in. When he came in, he was the first head of the DLC, the now defunct DLC. But this is 20 years later. And we've learned a lot about the implications of neoliberal policies and these basically, you know, these austerity programs. Andrew Cuomo is a privatizer. He has been attacking public schools. He is a tax cutter for corporations, tax cutter for millionaires, tax cutter when it comes to estate taxes. He is full-on austerity in terms of the cuts that he's imposing on a local level. And even if you just look at it from a partisan Democratic perspective, which, you know, I don't generally do, but even if you keep the blinders on there, this is a guy who has been very open about enabling the Republicans to control the Senate in New York State. And so this is a guy who he's going to win re-election, I think, and he's certainly not being challenged by the Republican. But there's an opportunity for a blue state like New York to send a message, not just to Andrew Cuomo, but to the entire Democratic Party, that you cannot act like a moderate Republican, because this guy's been very good on a couple of social issues. But the days of the Democratic Party being the home of deregulators, tax cutters for the sake of millionaires, program cutters, those days are ending. And so there's an opportunity, I think, for Democrats around the country to send a message to the party. And, Andrew Cuomo is the vehicle.
Yeah, and because of fusion voting in New York, you have a unique opportunity to do it with the, what's the name of the party, the Workers' Party?
The Working Families Party.
Working Families
and
Party, thank you.
Generally, they endorse Cuomo back in the day. They occasionally will run their own candidates. There's been talk. There's a story in the New York Times today saying that the Working Families Party and the Cuomo administration are trying to make some type of deal It's unclear whether or not that deal is going to work to get their endorsement. And if they don't endorse him, there's been two polls that show an unnamed candidate from the Working Families Party takes about 15-20% off of Cuomo's tally. And all you got to do is look across the Hudson River to see what a governor is willing to do to run up the numbers so that they become a national figure. And
you're talking about Chris Christie.
I'm talking about Chris Christie, who, you know, we know that not only is he involved in all the scandals to get people's endorsements, people forget that he refused to allow Cory Booker's special election to take place in November when his reelection was happening. He spent the tens of millions of dollars of state money for Cory Booker to run, to have his election just 30 days before his, so that Democrats would have less of a reason to come out and vote against him because he wanted to clear 62% or whatever it was so that he could be a national figure. Well, you know, that's the way politicians work.
Yeah.
And so Andrew Cuomo definitely wants to have a landslide in the state. The question is, will progressives prevent him from getting that?
Whatever happened to his dad? His dad was a pretty liberal Democrat, wasn't he?
You know, there's and one of the things that I hope to do in the coming weeks is to bring some people in. We all have that perspective of Mario Cuomo because of his speech.
Is he still alive?
Well, I believe he is. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And he gave, I think it was in the 1984. He gave a very moving speech, but I think his record is less progressive than we can imagine. But certainly, Andrew is, we call him Cuomo the Lesser around here.
Okay. Sam Cedar, starting next week, he will be sitting in this day part and 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern time every day of the week. Ring of Fire Radio. Thank you, Sam.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And be sure to check out ringoffireradio.com and majority.fm for more information on Sam. We'll be back. Back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. It's not even a consideration. It's really not a serious consideration. You know, one of the most powerful things I think I ever learned in my entire life was a lesson that I learned from my parents. And I can't tell you exactly when or how or where. It might have been more in the way they lived their lives. I remember my dad saying to me on a number of occasions, particularly when I was young, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, that it's not what happens to you that's important. It's how you react to what's happened to you. The only thing that's under your control is your own reaction to things. I mean, I remember that fairly clearly. It was almost a cliche. The other cliche that he used to repeat all the time was, if you can't say something nice about somebody, don't say anything at all. You know, he had some sayings, but he actually lived his life this way. And I've incorporated many of them into my life, some not as much as I would like, others fairly adequately, I think. And despair not being an option is one of them. I mean, just this idea that if you're upset about something, if you see something not working, like your country, instead of sitting around wringing your hands and complaining about it, and this has been, you know, one of my concerns with, you know, I look at these message boards, you know, I look at there's a couple of radio shows that I listen to, right wing, left wing, doesn't matter. And it's like it's complaint radio, it's complaint message, it's complaint op-eds. It's like, you know, enough already. Stop complaining and do something. And what I learned is that if you do things, those despairing or freaked out or whatever it may be, those emotions, they just go away because the energy gets converted in, you know, it's like converting potential energy into kinetic energy. You're taking emotional energy and converting it into kinetic, into physical energy. And I have never found a better cure for being bummed out or depressed, and I've certainly been there in my life, or, you know, upset or despaired or despairing or angry or whatever, than doing something. Walter in Leesburg, Virginia. Hey, Walter, what's on your mind today?
Hey, thanks, Tom. I'll tell you, the thing that's scaring me is, you always said, that the Republicans want to cut their way to prosperity all the time, and that's never going to work.
Never has.
Right. And that's what's worrying me. If they take over the Senate, which I am so scared that they're going to do, they are going to destroy this country so fast.
Actually, yes and no. This is kind of one of those good news, bad news stories. If they take over the Senate, or if they even get actually even, well, they don't even need one more vote because they've got enough. They already have a filibuster. If they just hold what they have, they will just continue to make life so miserable that people in all probability, because more than 60% of Americans can't tell you who controls the House and Senate, but more than 90% of Americans can tell you that a Democrat is in the White House, people are going to blame it on the Democratic Party. This is the Republican strategy for 2016. It's been the Republican strategy ever since the inauguration of Barack Obama, is to keep the country in pain in ways that nobody realizes that the Republicans, nobody outside of people who are well-informed politically, people like you, Walter, and me, we represent an absolute minority in America, that people don't realize who's causing the pain, and they will blame the pain on the president and the White House, and then in their hopes they will take over the White House in 2016. If the Republicans do that, I think 2014 is a very, this year is a very important election, and it's very important because of, not because of the negative potential, but because of the positive potential, which I'll get back to in just a second. But if they were to just hold the status quo until 2016, and then the Republicans were to take the White House and take the Senate and control all three branches of government, they would crash this economy so fast and so bad, it would be a repeat of 1928, 1929, 1930, 1931, 1932, all over again. A Republican administration, virtually any Republican, whether it's Mitt Romney or John McCain, I don't care, they're all singing the same economic song. They would repeat the mistakes of Warren Harding and Coolidge and Hoover because they are all preaching those mistakes. They would repeat those mistakes. They would throw us into a Great Depression. And that would be followed by an era like the New Deal, because the American people would get it finally that it's the Republicans who have been screwing things up and throw the bombs out. Now, the upside of 2014, forgive me, I'm starting to lose my voice here. The upside of 2014 is that if the Democrats take back the House, and if they can get one more seat in the Senate, I believe they just need one. I might be wrong. They might need two, but I think they just need one so that they don't have to worry about filibusters. Then President Obama will have 2 years to really get America back on track in a really, really rapid way. And his legacy as president will be better than the one that they've invented for Ronald Reagan, because there's so much pent-up demand in this country. There are so many people who are unemployed and need to go to work. There's so much opportunity. There's so much wealth in this country. There's so much good that could be done if we could just stop the Republican obstruction. And so, on the one hand, you know, I'm not afraid of the disaster of the Republicans taking over, because I know how, I've seen that movie before. We've all seen that movie before. We see that movie every 80 years in this country, and sometimes more frequently than that. We also saw it in 1896. But the thing that really jazzes me, that I am very hopeful about, is the possibility that Democrats could take the House and pick up a seat in the Senate in 2014. And if they can do that, then we could really see some change. And I really think we would see some change. So, Walter, rather than being scared, your word, take that scaredness and convert it into, like, working for some Democratic candidate who's, like, within 2 or 3 points of winning and making sure that that person beats a Republican in the House of Representatives. We've got to pick up, I think, 19 or 20 votes in the House of Representatives, and it's going to be a big lift, but it could be done. So, Walter, thanks for the call. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well said, as always.
Thank you.
I got a technical financial question for you to do with divesting.
Yeah.
Okay. When I have a bank account, let's say at Bank of America, and I find out they've been up to no good, they're a bunch of scoundrels, and let's say I've got a $10,000 savings account and a $10,000 CD, I decide to pull my money out and find another bank, whether it's a community bank or whatever, I can understand how they have $10,000 or $20,000 less in their working money to deal with the loan.
They actually have $100,000 or $200,000 less because their reserve requirement's only 10%, so they can loan out 10 times what you have on deposit. So you actually hurt them when you move money out of their bank.
Right. So I can understand pulling out my money out of a savings or a CD from a bank to another bank. But how does it work when a college or a city divests from a Walmart? Does Walmart immediately lose that money? Don't the people who divest have to first find someone who's willing to give that money to Walmart so they could take the money out of Walmart? Or does Walmart lose that immediately? How does that work?
Yeah, Johnny, what you have touched upon is the big conundrum of stock divestment and frankly of ethical investing. Because the fact of the matter is that if, say, Harvard owns $1 billion worth of Walmart stock and they decide to sell it and they go to the New York Stock Exchange and they say, okay, here's the stock. It's, $100 a share. It's for sale. Somebody else is going to buy it. Walmart never sees a penny of it. It doesn't influence Walmart at all. And Harvard might have been actually making good money on that Walmart investment. It might have been a good idea. And this is the argument that the investment managers have made for years and years, is that divestment does not hurt the company at all. What it does, however, is it makes a moral statement. And this is largely how it happened during the South African divestment activity, was by having institution after institution, respected institution after respected institution after respected institution, say, I will not, or we will not, as an institution, we will not hold stock in companies that trade in fossil fuels or that trade in tobacco or that trade in armaments or weapons of war, or in South Africa, in the case of South Africa, or in Walmart, in the case of Walmart. What you are doing is creating a moral example. It doesn't hurt the company that you're selling the stock at all. And that's why at the level of the individual investor, the responsible investment or whatever for most people is, something that is just an issue. It's a moral issue. It's not an economic issue. And if you're concerned about the economics, then, put that first. The only time that a company gets money from somebody buying stock is at the initial offering. When a company does an IPO, an initial stock offering, then when you buy the stock, that money that you put in goes to the company. Forevermore, then, when you sell that stock to somebody else, you're simply selling stock to somebody else. And then they sell it to somebody else, they sell it to somebody else. The company never sees that money again. If a divestment, the one way that you could hurt a company, Johnny, is if enough institutions were to divest themselves of a particular company's stock rapidly enough, they could temporarily depress the stock price. But the odds are that the stock price would bounce back up, because stock prices are based on valuation, not on this kind of thing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So it's a moral statement. But a moral statement, don't underestimate the power of the moral statement. That's Cesar Chavez with the grapes. That was a moral statement. It worked. Welcome back. Peter in New Windsor, New York. Hey, Peter, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. First, let me say I'm a big fan of yours. I really appreciate the work that you're doing. And just to bring your listeners up to speed, they may not have all watched your Lone Rumble last night on RT News, but I just wanted to respectfully disagree with you regarding your views on unions and what you had said about bringing back the unions to labor. I have to tell you, if you had made that same comment a few years ago, I would have been behind you 1,000%. But recently I served for 3.5 years as a president of a union, and then I retired. And all I found is that the unions are doing is throwing the members under the bus. They're collecting their dues. They give themselves raises every year, raise the dues even when they negotiate 0% raises. people getting laid off left and right, some being wrongfully discharged. They're not backing up the workers. They're just collecting their money and not really working for it. And I've really become jaded on the whole union movement after having 3.5 years of experience pounding my head on the table, you know, filing grievance after grievance, improper practice charges with a public employee.
How could you file a grievance or an improper practice charge if you were the head of the union? Are you filing them against yourself?
I'm filing them against management, and the union's not following through on it.
Oh, I see.
I'm acting as a representative of my constituents, the members.
Right.
And then I go to the parent union where they have their legal department, and all of these IP charges, all of these discharge and Title VII violations, laying off only the black workers. All of this stuff the union is just throwing into the garbage, doing nothing with it. After 3.5 years, I left a term as president. I hadn't yet finished the term, and I decided just to retire and get out because I got so tired of being the fighter in the middle of the ring and getting caught with a few right hooks, and I'm turning to my corner man to see what type of advice my corner man can give me, and I find my corner man is running out of the stadium.
Yeah. You know, Peter, there are some unions around the country where the war on workers has been so successful that the unions themselves are in a state of decline and decay, and just like with businesses, basically they're just hanging on by their fingernails and trying to get what they can. And those are the situations where the workers themselves, you know, should be standing up and doing something. I actually was in a workplace that decertified a union some years ago. I voted to keep the union, but, you know, I was in the minority. And the thing about unions, and what I said last night on in the debate, is that a union is a democratic institution inside a non-democratic institution, which is the workplace. And for the purposes of both democracy and economy, we should have that. So I'm sorry to hear your story, Peter. I suspect that, you know, there's more than a few, you know, bad locals floating around, or bad even nationals floating around. But by and large, if you look at the history of the union movement in the United States, you look at the history of union density. When unions have been at their peak, inequality has been lowest and the middle class has been strongest. It's a very, very simple equation. So Peter is the exception that proves the rule, in my opinion. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. AIDS, Nate A times 2. Bob Nay with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us today, author of Sideswiped, former Republican member of the House of Representatives, U.S. House of Representatives, reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Hey, Bob.
Hello, how are you?
I am well. So what's going on today?
Well, a few things. Of course, the VA situation continues to rage on with Senator Shaheen, Democratic senator, who last night at 11 o'clock had put out a release about asking for the secretary to step down. Now, a surprising move, House Speaker John Boehner basically kind of tiptoed around the thing. Machiavellian people up on the Hill who think Machiavellian political ways think maybe Boehner likes Shinseski, you know, dangling there in the wind, but I think part of it, with some of the members who are not calling for his resignation, are asking the jackpot question, what happens if he goes?
Go
so in, within the White House, they're as I'm told anyway, they're trying to amass some type of plan, you know, that if he does go, which people are thinking next 48 hours, Tom, he'll go. He'll step down.
Yeah, because he's basically become a pinata.
That's it.
And that's not good. And that's not good for him. It's not good for the administration. It's not good for the VA. And ultimately, I think Boehner recognizes that he's become a pinata. But Boehner doesn't want to be the guy who's accused of busting it open.
That's right. And then there'll be the issue with the president trying to find a replacement. But that's not the main issue. The main issue is how they're going to tackle, you know, the situation. There's 1,400 VA entities, 153 some of actual hospitals, 800 some clinics throughout America, nursing homes, et cetera. So 1,400 some entities, and that is going to take funding. So it might be a good time for the White House to be able to push that because...
Well, and this is the other problem that John Boehner has, is that he has been a party to denying funding to the VA over the past, these many years, at the same time that he was a party to the Bush wars, which have put this insane stress on the VA.
And that's why I was responding earlier to a question asked on air about did I think John Boehner had a change of heart on the whole situation. I don't think so, but I think he knows this could turn on a dime, and it's a very difficult, tough issue. It could turn on a dime against the Republicans if they look at the history of the cuts and the lack of participation on that end. So this is just going to still continue to be focused on just the secretary until I believe he'll step down, which, again, should be in about 48 hours. Yeah. Now, there's another battle, Tom, on the Hill, which is the First Lady and the Republicans. And there was a House committee which did approve a measure going against Michelle Obama's healthy food stance. And I find it very interesting because it's being billed by the right as, against the First Lady and her program, as if it was like Nancy Reagan and, just say no to the drugs. It's just the First Lady supporting certain food standards, and, she has an anti-obesity campaign. So it's really kind of turned into a kind of a right-wing, we're getting the First Lady campaign.
Wow.
Instead of about food.
Wow. I wonder if they would...
Was their provision to opt out.
Yeah. My first thought was, I wonder if they would do that if she was white. And then I recalled that that's exactly what they did with Hillary when Bill put her in charge of promoting a health program, is they went after Hillary Clinton. So I guess they just don't like first ladies or something. I don't know.
Well, and what they're saying, the congressman from Alabama, Republican Robert Aderholt, he wrote the language, which would be gutting the standards program. And the Republicans are saying the standards are an overreach and that the bottom line, this is a quote, bottom line is that schools are finding the regulations to be much too quick. Well, I think we've known in America that, we've had some really bad food standards for quite a long time. And I think the schools, have been braced for that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think
but there are
a really...
There's also some serious lobbying going on about this. I read a piece that one of the largest pizza companies is involved in this thing, and the Food Manufacturers Association, and they got pizza reclassified as a vegetable. I mean, not just pizza sauce, but pizza itself. And, just some weird stuff that has happened, over the years that the fast food industry is very happy with, and they don't want to see this stuff go away and just be replaced by cheap local fresh fruits and vegetables.
And then they also regionalized it, that there are certain cultural differences on food. Well, no one is saying that you can't have, certain Cajun food in Louisiana. They're,
right.
they're just saying that there are certain standards.
Just make it fresh.
Yes, and certain standards they want. One other issue, Tom, I wanted to mention because I find this one fascinating. There's $39.2 billion in the 2015 spending bill for the Department of Homeland Security, and now it's cleared a House Appropriations Subcommittee and yesterday evening, and, of course, that's Republican-controlled, and it has bipartisan praise, but it includes earmark about $900 million more for Homeland Security than the president wanted. And it focuses budget increases on border security, but included $76.9 million for immigration so it can safely transport child migrants to health services facilities where they can be cared for. And the reason I found that interesting, as this whole battle internally rages over immigration and immigration reform, I find it amazing that the Republicans are putting that much money into migrants. So they're recognizing, in other words, that those children – need to be taken care of, and that they are, the old debate about, well, if the parents are illegal, you just ship them back. I just thought it was very fascinating to see that coming out of the House.
Yeah, yeah. This is the the Chamber of Commerce Republicans, you know, are starting to say, if as a party we don't recognize the growing power of the Latino population, we're toast. Is this a symptom of that?
Yes, I think so. And in July, it's going to come to a head because House Speaker John Boehner and the Republicans, especially in the House, are going to have to make a decision of where they want to be on the immigration issue, right, at least by around July.
Last question, Bob, is, you know, John Boehner still holds the vote on whether to extend long-term unemployment. Any chance he's going to do that?
I can't see him budging on it, and it's a terrible mistake as time goes on, not only...
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Get over to my call screen software here. Whoops, wrong button. The right button is always a useful thing. Judson Phillips is on the line with us. Judson is an attorney and the founder of Tea Party Nation, teapartynation.com, the website. And Judson, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Doing good. Doing good. Summer, it's wonderful. I just can't wait for a little more global warming.
Yeah. Well, we're getting it. We're definitely getting it. I understand that you're on a tear here about people who work for the IRS who owe back taxes. Tell me about this.
Well, I don't know if I'd call it a tear. I think I've got some common sense ideas about it because one congressman has proposed firing people who owe back taxes or at least firing federal employees who owe back taxes. And, you know, I can understand the outrage. I think federal employees probably should keep their taxes up. But you know what? We've got a real problem with our tax code here in America. And I'm not talking about the rates, the whole issue of, you know, should the rates be, you know, 10%, 20%, whatever. But we've got a tax code right now that is so complicated, average Americans either need a sophisticated computer program or an accountant to figure it out. And if that's just your average person's taxes, and I'm not talking about a Mitt Romney, I'm talking about your average, everyday, middle-class American, I mean, something is wrong with that.
Well, there's an easy solution for that, Judson.
Well, there's a number of easy solutions.
Well, there's one that's actually already been proposed. It was filibustered by Republicans. But it was that the IRS calculate your taxes and send the form to you at the end of the year, and you have until April 15th to look at the form and make sure that it's right. And if it's right, you sign it and mail it back and either include a check or they will send you one. And if it's wrong, you correct it and send them the corrections. And the big tax software companies, the TurboTaxes or whatever they are, the big tax software companies dropped a whole pile of money in the laps of a bunch of Republican members of Congress, and they filibustered this attempt to have this happen.
Well, given what we've seen from the IRS in the last few years, not only their general lack of competence, but their political manipulations.
The political manipulations, Judson, has been demonstrated to be a fraud. That is a Darrell Issa stunt to get publicity for. I think he's the only member of Congress who's actually a convicted criminal. The guy's a clown, and the so-called IRS scandal is a non-event. And the IRS actually does a pretty decent job, although Republicans have been really, really good at scaling back the number of people that they have who can do audits. So they have not been able to audit rich people, particularly during the Bush years. They basically stopped auditing rich people. I think we do need to get those back going again. But yeah, I think it would be great to have the IRS just send me my tax forms and say, here, this is, you know, because they get copies of everything. You know, your employer sends your or if you're self-employed, you send the stuff to the IRS every quarter. And at the end of the year, they've got it. They've got it in the computer. The computer has the algorithms and the formulas. They push a button, they spit it out, they drop it in the mail to you. It would be so easy, and it would put all these tax software companies and H&R Block, it would put them out of business. And so these private for-profit corporations are trying to make taxes difficult for us.
Private for-profit corporations have an incentive. There's so many special interests in Washington that have an incentive in keeping our tax code Byzantine.
Oh, I agree. This is why I think that we should say that you know, the George Washington did not fight the Revolutionary War on behalf of the billionaires. The word money does not appear in the First Amendment. And in 2010, when Antonin Scalia discovered it there somehow magically, he was just plain old flat out wrong.
Oh, you're talking about Citizens United.
Of course.
You're talking about my favorite case, the case that every American should love because it saved the First Amendment.
Yeah, every American should read the dissent
every
by John
American
Paul Stevens in that case. But Judson, let me just go back to the original thing, if I may, because I know that Fox News is making a big deal about this. And over on your side of the media, in the right-wing talk radio and right-wing websites and Fox News, that everybody's hysterical about the fact that apparently IRS employees in aggregate, and there are, I guess, what, over 100,000 of them? Or thousands?
There's a lot of them.
Tens of thousands of them, anyway. In aggregate, they owe lots and lots of back taxes. And so, therefore, you know, let's get them. And I'm wondering, do you think that, you know, all doctors with hemorrhoids should be disbarred? Do you think that, anybody who, I haven't had time enough to think of, you know, a dozen different equally absurd analogies, but why pick on federal employees? This just seems like it's more, you know, trashing of federal employees.
Well, let's start with some basic things, particularly with the IRS employees. How does the government not know where these people are to go get the money that the government says?
Well, they do. And if there's an IRS employee who's got back taxes that they owe, they are either in the process of paying them or they're being garnished, or if they're getting away with it, it's because the Republicans keep cutting the budget for the IRS inspectors, and the IRS employees, who are probably not in the inspection department, have been able to avoid their own people. And that's wrong. I agree. But I don't think that saying that we should single out people in the IRS, I think that's infantile.
Well, there's a bigger problem here, and there's also, I think, a good solution. I've always thought it absurd that federal employees pay federal taxes. I mean, literally, you're giving with one hand, taking straight back with the other. It would make a lot more sense. Let's cut federal salaries by 20% or 30%, whatever the good number is, and then for a federal employee, your tax or your salary is tax exempt. And instead of having to file a complicated return that has to be processed and figured out the whole nine yards, all you have to do is check one little box on a simple form that says, I'm a federal employee, therefore my pay is exempt from federal taxes. And then it cuts down the cost of managing federal employees. It cuts down the cost of having federal employees.
Yeah, and you guys get a twofer. Number one, you cut the salaries of federal employees, and number two, you cut income into the taxes. I'm not going to go along with it. I realize that they tried doing that with Social Security. In fact, they still are in some areas. There are, for example, school districts that don't participate in Social Security because of loopholes like that Republicans drilled into the law. But these are just attempts to screw up the tax code. I'm not, you know, it doesn't matter. Again, it's like, you know, like I said, you know, if you've got a doctor who's got high blood pressure, should he be banned from practicing medicine just because he you know, isn't taking good care of himself? I think if he's a decent doctor, it's, you know, it's his business whether he's got high blood pressure. If an IRS employee is doing their job, I don't care if they owe the IRS money or not. That's between them and the IRS. It's not none of my damn business.
This is one where you and I are going to disagree, because I think, especially if they work for the IRS, especially if they're getting into the lives of somebody else, if they're auditing somebody, And by the way, just to go off on a quick tangent, one of the first things that the government, that the Republicans need to change, and I'm pushing for on my side, is if the IRS wants to audit you, they need to comply with the requirements of the Fourth Amendment. Because I will tell you, an IRS audit is the textbook definition of an unreasonable search and seizure. So if you want to go audit somebody, go get a warrant from a judge where you can show probable cause that a crime is being committed.
You know, let me chew on that one. I might not disagree with you. I think that for somebody to be audited, because audits are expensive, time-consuming, all that kind of thing, that there should be some measure of demonstrated concern. I feel the same way, by the way, about airport inspections. And, you know, so maybe the Fourth Amendment is making us friends here. Judson Phillips,
absolutely.
Tea Party Nation, the founder of Tea Party Nation, the website teapartynation.com, and an attorney as well. Judson, always good talking with you.
Tom, likewise. Have a good summer.
Thanks for dropping by. You too. We'll be back. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Why do right-wingers always want to beat up on federal employees? Oh, wait a minute. They're unionized. I forgot. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Robert watching Free Speech TV in Delhi, Louisiana. Am I saying that right, or is it Delhi?
Delhi.
Okay. Robert, what's up?
Well, there's been a big talk about the Keystone Pipeline.
Yeah, we were discussing that earlier.
I don't know if people in America know about how many pipelines are going across and headed across the country. And I'm wondering, do the states get taxes on these pipelines, or do they get free gratis, or how does that work?
I don't honestly know. Somebody called and asked that question a week or so ago, and I put it on my mental list of things to track down when I have time, and I haven't had time.
If you look up the Keystone Pipeline, it shows it and everything. But
yeah, in fact, the question was, could each state that the Keystone Pipeline goes through say oil is entering and leaving our state and we're going to charge a tariff on it and tax it at the point of entry and the point of exit? And I don't know if that's legal, and I don't know if there's precedent for or against that. I know that Alaska has done a really, really good job. You know, when they discovered oil up there back in the 70s, they put together the Alaska Permanent Fund, and they said, you know, we're going to charge a fairly steep tax on the oil companies when they extract the oil and move it out of the state. And they put that money, they've got billions of dollars in that fund, and every citizen in Alaska, every man, woman, and child, every year gets a check for roughly $2,000. So you have a guarantee, and this is just out of the interest from the fund. The principal, they don't touch the principal; it just keeps growing, and so Alaska basically has a guaranteed minimum income. Sarah Palin, with her five kids, she gets she's got five kids plus her and her husband, that's seven. Seven times 2,000, that's 14. They get $14,000 a year just for living in Alaska. And so, you know, that guaranteed minimum income has actually reduced inequality in the state of Alaska. I think, you know, we should be doing that all over the country with our natural resources. Say what?
I think every state in America has the potential to do that.
I think you may well be right, Robert. It's just, do they have the political will to stand up to the oil industry, the coal industry? I mean, you know, why is it that Alaska has this multi-billion-dollar permanent fund and a guaranteed minimum income, and West Virginia doesn't? And West Virginia, you know, arguably exports as much carbon, in this case in the form of coal, as Alaska does in the form of oil. Why doesn't Kentucky, which also is a major coal exporter? Why doesn't Pennsylvania, which is a major coal exporter, why don't these other states do what Alaska did? And I think the answer is fairly clear, that these states have been under the control of the fossil fuel barons since the 19th century. But still, it's never too late. And if the people woke up, it's just that down in the lower 48, people don't know what they did up in Alaska. And, you know, you're living in Louisiana. A lot of oil goes through your state. A lot of oil coming out of the waters offshore from your state. And Louisiana should have a permanent fund so that you and everybody in Louisiana gets that $2,000 a year check. Robert, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back. It's Shama Swan is going to be with us, member of the Seattle City Council and the leader in the 15 Now campaign. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. And Shama Swant is with us, a member of the Seattle City Council, leader of the 15 Now campaign, the Socialist Party member, seattle.gov/council/Sawant, S-A-W-A-N-T, and the K is silent in Shama's name. Anybody ever draw parallels between that and Django?
I don't think so, not yet.
That was such a great line where he goes, you know, the D is silent, you know.
And, you know, in reality, the K is not actually silent, but I say that because it makes everybody's life easier.
Ah, okay. Okay, so
and also
so,
another clarification. I'm a member of Socialist Alternative, not Socialist Party.
Oh, okay, Socialist Alternative. Thank you very much. So, Shama or Kashama, tell us what's up. What's going on with the 15 Now campaign?
So, what has happened today in Seattle? The Seattle City Council's Committee on Income Inequality and Minimum Wage has just passed out of its committee to vote for a $15 an hour minimum wage for all the 100,000 workers in this city who are at low wages. This is absolutely historic.
Wow.
On Monday, June 2nd, the full council will be meeting. The bill has gone to the full council. I expect it to be voted on and passed as law. This is absolutely incredible. And what's incredible about this is, one, the pace at which this has happened. You know, remember, we ran our campaign last year, a socialist campaign, for city council demanding $15 an hour. Fast food workers in Manhattan walked out in fall of 2012, and it's been less than 2 years since then that we've won this. This is record speed for winning a major social change. And this has happened because it was led by workers, by the working class movement, by the 15 Now grassroots campaign, by the labor movement. This is a great time for all of us to remember that social change happens not because of the largesse of the political elite under capitalism, but because when we go out and demand it.
Yeah, I am totally with you. And first question, does this apply to tipped workers as well?
Yes, it applies to all workers. And that's also, you know, an absolutely the step in the right direction. But I also want to clarify that the other city council members, you know, who are representing business, they have managed to pass corporate loopholes like a temporary tip credit, meaning, you know, temporarily, at least during the phase-in period, tipped workers will have to make up for their full wages with their tips. But, you know, we were arguing to not have any tip credit at all. And the reason some of these corporate loopholes went through despite the movement is that, you know, is basically because, you know, business really was brought to the table by the Democratic Party. You know, the movement brought 15 to the table. The Democratic Party establishment brought business to the table, who succeeded in watering it down. And the lesson we should take from this is twofold. One, this is an unambiguous victory for the strength of the working class, and we should feel so empowered and take the message of 15 Now all over the country. And second, if we want to make sure to eliminate corporate loopholes, then the movement has to be strong enough to overcome the counterattacks from business. It's all the result of a balance of forces. So if we want to succeed, we have to build our forces.
I am absolutely with you. You represent to me a conundrum. A bit of a riddle, and I wanted to share this thought with you and get your thoughts on it. I publicly have been dismissive relatively over the years of the great man theory of history, that if this person hadn't come along, that wouldn't have happened. If Franklin Roosevelt hadn't been there, there wouldn't have been the New Deal. If Gandhi hadn't come along, India would not be independent, whatever. and instead have always felt that when the time is right, when the time is pregnant, that the people, that the, if the parade is big enough marching down the street, a politician will emerge who will jump in front of the parade and lift the flag and say, this is my parade. And if they're at all competent, history will record them as the great leader who made it happen. And yet, when you first came on the scene and started running for the Seattle City Council, and we had you on this program, and there was, you know, conventional wisdom was it was a real long shot. You were unabashedly saying these things, you know, a socialist alternative and minimum wage and all these things, and you are perceived as a great leader now, as you know, as fulfilling the great man, or in this case, great woman theory of history. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
I really appreciate you asking this question, Tom. I think it's a very important question, and probably a lot of people on the left are reflecting on that themselves, you know, especially young people who are just moving into political activism. And it's very important for us to be clear. And I think the conundrum arises from, you know, the distinction between different types of leadership, or what is called leadership under capitalism. So the example that you gave of a corporate politician who, you know, who sees which way the wind is blowing, the workers and all the grassroots activists build the movement, and then, you know, typically it's the Democratic Party person, somebody comes up, picks up the flag and takes the credit. I think that sort of false leadership is always damaging, and I think the skepticism with which you and others are viewing, and I myself included, with which we view that, is important. It is important to be completely distrusting and actually rejecting that kind of a false leadership, which really is not leadership, but co-opting the movement.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happened here, and I feel somewhat awkward because, you know, in a way I'm talking about myself, but really, just in the abstract, you know, the leaders that emerge from a genuine grassroots movement, a movement that is genuinely fighting for social justice,
mm-hmm.
those leaders are created by the movement. You know, the movement creates the leaders it needs, just like the capitalist system creates its own spokespeople in order to survive itself.
Right.
You know, so we have to, the false leaders that the exploitative system creates have to be countered by our genuine leaders. But our leadership emerges from the strength
from the movement.
Of the grassroots movement.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what I was...
And most importantly, our leadership is accountable to the movement.
Yeah, I think that's what actually I was trying to say. You've recalibrated it slightly for me. Thank you. That's brilliant and insightful. Hang on just a second. We're going to get stepped on here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Chama Swan, thanks so much for being with us, and thanks for the great work you've done.
Thank you so much, Tom.
It's a pleasure and honor always to talk to you. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. National Resources Defense Council is calling out the Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber of Commerce has said that the Obama administration has got new rules for how much carbon emission can be emitted by coal, gas, oil-fired power plants. And the Chamber of Commerce came up with a study saying, it's going to destroy the economy. The National Resources Defense Council says, not only is that not true, it's a lie. Meanwhile, the Koch brothers are running another ad, this one in Michigan, talking about how the health care prices in Michigan are going up 40% because this Democratic congressman supported the Affordable Care Act. And it turns out that they're sourcing that to an article that was in Forbes that sourced it to a study that was done by Morgan Stanley that sourced it to six brokers, insurance salesmen, who guessed it. Yeah. Guessed it or something close to that. And who said it, basically. Six brokers say premiums are rising on 40% of the people in the state. And therefore, it's all terrible. Yeah. It's getting strange out there. I'm telling you, it's just getting strange out there. And when Americans for Prosperity and you know, other Koch brother front groups start with just like these really rather unprincipled ads just because they can. I think, frankly, there's a pushback coming. I think Americans are waking up, and we're seeing this in Connecticut, or in Kentucky, excuse me, with Connect. This program, KYNECT, it's the Kentucky version of Medicaid, because Kentucky has a Democratic governor, and they took the Medicaid expansion money, and now Kentuckians all have Medicaid and all have Obamacare via Medicaid, and Mitch McConnell says, oh, it's terrible, we got to repeal it, we got to replace it. And now Mitch McConnell is saying, oh, well, let's repeal it and replace it for the whole rest of the country, but let's keep it for Connecticut. Or how does John Stewart does that, McTurtle? Why don't we repeal it? You know, anyway, it's pretty amazing. I think it's entirely possible that the Republicans have really overreached on this stuff, that Americans are figuring out that unemployment extensions have been stalled since Christmas by John Boehner in the House of Representatives, by Republicans. That you know, any kind of jobs program that would put people back to work, rebuilding our infrastructure and things, have been stopped, have been blocked by Republicans. That the stories, the horror stories that were told about how Obamacare would be the end of the world, turned out to have been lies from Republicans. I think Americans are figuring this out, and I think that we're going to see the result of that in this election. Libby with WAMEN.org. How's it going with the petition drive in Washington State to get enough signatures on the petition to get a ballot initiative to say corporations aren't people and money isn't speech in the great state of Washington over at WAMEND, WAMEND.org? How's it going, Libby?
Hi, Tom. Well, it's going hot and heavy. We are in the last month of our signature gathering, and we need all hands on deck that we possibly can find. We have a lot of petitions out that are finding their way back now, or need to be finding their way back now. It looks tough. The numbers are scary right now, but I think we can still do it. If everybody who cares about this issue can send a petition, get it filled with 20 signatures and sent back into us, we'll make it.
Great. So get over to, if you're in the state of Washington, get over to WAMEN.org, get a petition, print out a petition, get signatures of registered voters, and send it into WAMEN. And if you're outside the state of Washington, go over to WAMEN, W-A-M-E-N-D, the Washington State Move to Amend, basically, WAMEN.org. And A, see what they're doing and do it in your state, and B, send them a few bucks to help them out. Libby, thanks a lot and good luck. And we'll talk again, I'm sure, soon. Mark in Chico, California. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, I called last Friday and talked to Senator Sanders about my feet. And I got a call back from his staff, and they're going to try to see what they can do for me.
Oh, that's great. I remember you were the guy, you were a vet who was having a problem with the VA.
Yes. And I do want to say that I want to thank you and your staff, and I want to thank Senator Sanders and their staff. And I think VA is a good place, but there's a lot of people in it, and we need more doctors. And I really want to thank you and your staff for giving people like me a voice, and it has helped. And
good.
It's
good.
Got me. It's brought me out of my depression somewhat. So
that's great.
Hopefully, something can get done.
Well, Mark, thank you for checking back in with us, and I'll pass that along to Bernie on Friday. And for that matter, Friday's tomorrow, isn't it? For that matter. When is Bernie going to be with us? Do we know yet? We don't know if he's going to be with us at noon or at 3. You know, if you hear Bernie on, feel free to call in and tell him yourself. We'll let that call through again. Or I'll try and remember to to pass it along. So he's going to be here at noon. Yeah, he'll be here at noon rather than 3 o'clock. So if you have an opportunity, you won't be able to see him on Free Speech TV at noon, but you can check him out on our website or on his website. Actually, you'd have to go to our website, I guess. It's going to take a couple of weeks for this whole transition to make it on TV. But Mark, thank you for the call, and good luck. Good luck and God bless. Curtis in Lancaster, California, listening to KPFK. Hey, Curtis, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a first-time caller and a fairly new listener, so it may well be that that you've already gone over some of the things that that I wanted to mention here. In case, then maybe you can just enlighten me on what the discussion has been. But I'm calling about a potential technology for actually removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. I know you've had a lot of discussions about global warming,
mm-hmm.
but have you discussed something called biochar?
No.
Okay. Well, good. Then I'd like to spread the word a little bit.
Okay.
We all know that it's easy to put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and not very easy to take it out, but there is this one technology which, in my view, looks promising. And I think the word biochar kind of gives you a hint as to what it might mean. That would be the inefficient burning of biofuels like, you know, wood or what have you.
Right.
And when you do it in a shortage of oxygen, instead of getting all CO2, you get some CO2, you get some reduced products, and you get something called char, and it's called biochar for the source. In any case, that is quite different from what happens to plant matter when you allow it.
So let me translate this into English if I can. What you're saying is that if you burn wood in an environment that is a lot of heat but a reduced amount of oxygen, that you will extract much of the potential energy out of that wood, but what is left behind is physical carbon as opposed to all of the carbon becoming atmospheric carbon in the form of carbon dioxide.
Exactly.
Okay.
And we don't know just how long carbon can last in the presence of atmosphere and sunlight, but it's far longer than the ordinary rotting that goes on.
Right. And it might balance out all the methane that's going into our atmosphere now from fracking and from whatnot, because that has 20-some-odd-year lifespan, or half-life. Yeah, excellent point, Curtis. Thank you for calling and sharing that. I appreciate it and putting that on the map. Thank you. Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Paul.
I was listening to your conversation with Kashama Savant, and you mentioned that your theory or anti-theory of the great man theory.
Yeah.
And you would be in the very good company of Leo Tolstoy with that idea. He explained that in the epilogue of War and Peace.
Oh, really?
He also didn't believe that it's all about one great man. It's many great men, and he kind of went through and reflected upon Napoleon's march into Russia and all, and how this was none of this was one great man. And when you think about, you asked Kashama what, you know, it's quite remarkable what's going on here with the $15 an hour minimum wage, because if she were just sort of one radical nutcase, you know, that somehow got elected to that position on the city council, there would be other people just say, oh, yeah, she's just, rolled her eyes. But she's getting somewhere, and she's getting somewhere without fighting people. She's done an interview with a, the local right-wingers are pillaring her all over the place,
sure.
The local talkers. And she did a debate with one of them, and she did not fight with him.
Right.
He fought with her, but she didn't fight with him.
Yeah, she is so elegant. She is so precise and so thoughtful. And she actually offered alternative three, which is the people he hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Alternative three, which is that people emerge out of the movement and they become the great men and women. And that I hadn't really considered before. Thank you, Paul. Welcome back. Michael, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. I've talked to you so many times, and I thank you for that. I've never gotten conspiracy on you, but after hearing from Maude Barlow and that children in Detroit are being taken away from their parents because they can't afford a $150 water bill, I got to go conspiracy on you. I know you've heard of Jesse Ventura. He had a show of an underground structure, which is being built in the Ozarks, which is absolutely unbelievable. The structure on top of that structure is 72,000 feet, which is bigger than the White House. And that, am I crazy or is something going on with by the Wetico Ridge? I mean, could you please check that out and get back to us? Thank you, Tom.
Well, Michael, 72,000 square feet is not that big. I mean, you got Walmarts that are that size.
But that's just above ground. We don't even know. You should see the structure that's underground. They got loading bays.
And the question in my mind, Michael, if they're taking children away from their parents because their parents had their water cut off because they were $150 in arrears on their water bill, is there a for-profit child care industry in Detroit?
Okay, that I don't know.
I don't know the answer to the question either. But if there is a for-profit child care industry, if there's a for-profit foster care industry in the city of Detroit, then what we're seeing is the equivalent of the for-profit prison industry.
And God, Tom, I hope we're not getting
And we're using water to drive people into it rather than using Nixon's war on drugs to drive people into it. And it might not even be that. I mean, it might be I was up in New Hampshire last weekend, and they built the John Sununu Child Care Center, and it's basically the new children's prison, and it's only half full. And so, you know, they're out there looking for ways to find kids to stick them in the John Sununu Children's Center, and the psych hospital and jail kind of thing, and warehouse them because it's there, and the state spent the money on it, and they named it after a famous Republican, and, you know, it's like, really? I mean, it's not inconceivable that there's even some, you know, sometimes the libertarians are right. You know, the bureaucrats screw things up, whether they're in government or in corporations. So, you know.
Yes, you got your butt. Aren't these prisons becoming like hotels? You don't build a hotel to have a vacant bed. When you build a prison, you need that bed filled. And that's just like a prison. And people in jail are destroying their lives. That's crazy.
Well, it goes beyond that, Michael. The contracts that these states sign with these private prison corporations like CCA, Correction Corporation of America, the contracts specify that they must have a 90% occupancy rate, and if they don't, the states have to pay for it even if the beds are empty.
That's crazy. All right. Thank you, Tom. I don't want to take your time, but isn't it crazy, man? It's just crazy.
Yeah, it is. I agree. Thank you, Michael. Thanks for the call. And this is a serious problem. This is, if you look at the incarceration rates in the United States, over at Daily Kos right now, there's a couple of good graphs about incarceration. And they particularly point out Louisiana, this explosion of incarceration. And they talk about it being state policy. And I didn't have time to, frankly, read all the details of the article or read the links out of the article. But I did see the graphs where they were breaking out Louisiana, Alabama. There are a couple of states that are just like the outliers, where just over the last 15 years, the state prison populations have exploded. And I don't know the answer. I'm wondering, are these the states where they have privatized prisons? We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Rich in Jefferson City, Missouri. What's up, Rich?
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to talk about the Obama administration and its links to the business roundtable. You were just talking about the Chamber of Commerce. This is kind of the Chamber of Commerce on steroids.
The business roundtable is a group of the CEOs of the 100 largest companies in America. In fact, Jon Snow, who was Bush's Secretary of Transportation, was formerly the president of the business roundtable.
Right. That's changed, but the president had it's called a presidential export council, and he appointed 28 private sector members, and those 28 private sector members happened to be CEOs. There wasn't anybody from a union, anybody from like the ACLU, no advocates for the public. anyway, of these 28 members, most of them are part of the Business Roundtable. And as it turns out, they happen to be advocates for the TPP, which was what was...
Surprise, surprise!
ultimately come out of that council was the support for the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right.
But anyway, some of the facts about it, they show right on their site, and one of the most interesting is they do $7.4 trillion annual revenue. $4.7 trillion annual revenue. They brag about this, but in that same paragraph, they talk about $9 billion in charitable donations. Now, if you did the percentage of that, you'd see how big their hearts are. That's pretty small for the blessed.
What is that as a percentage? I can't do math that fast.
I think it's like 0.0001%, and I actually think it's smaller.
Far less than 1%. Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable, but... Like I said, these were the people that advocated for that. But just recently, they had a bonus depreciation tax. And this is just one tax, and it's called the bonus depreciation tax. If you heard that, you would think, well, they're talking about, you know, bonuses, doing something about bonuses. But it isn't. It's about new capital and equipment. Companies can write that off as a tax deduction, 50% tax deduction. And I think it was done during the Bush administration, but anyway, it just came up for renewal, and they thought the Democratic Senate would stop it, but obviously with one Bernie Sanders and a bunch of moderate Republicans, it's hard to do, but that's just one tax, and they said that one tax over 10 years, and this isn't a big tax, a lot of people didn't hear about it, that's $256 billion in 10 years is what they say it's going to cost the taxpayers. Now, if these people were embedded in the Obama administration as well as the Bush administration, if you want to know where the cabal is, it's right there in public. It's,
oh, yeah.
You know, you can find it.
No, it's Robert Rubin and Larry Summers. And these guys are pretty upfront about who they are, what they're all about. And yeah, the Obama administration, the Bush administration, the Clinton administration. I think the last Democrat as president who wasn't really part of this was Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter left office and did not become a millionaire. In fact, Jim, our video guy, went down and met with Jimmy Carter a couple of weekends ago and listened to his Sunday sermon in Plains, Georgia, in his church. And Jimmy Carter's traveling around the world, you know, doing good work. And we need more people like him. We need him. We need people like that back. I'm sorry to hear this news, Rich, but thanks for calling and sharing it with us. Phil in Oak Park, Illinois. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Okay, good program, Tom.
Thank you, Phil.
When you had the guy from the Tea Party talking and you got onto taxes and you suggested alternatives, I was hoping you were going to mention the automated payment transaction tax. Do you know of it?
No, I don't.
Well, it replaces all the income taxes, fuel tax, capital gains tax, gift tax, estate tax, excise taxes and sales taxes, and that's hard to believe. But what you do is you tax all transactions. The guy gets a paycheck, you tax it. He deposits the bank, you tax it. You tax both the receiver and the giver. If you want more information, they have a very good web page. When people hear about this, they say, how can that possibly be? And I wish you would Google it and look it up and do a little research because it's wonderful.
Well, it sounds like a financialized version of a VAT tax.
Well, it essential is, but everybody pays it. You would pay it in lieu of a sales tax every time you went to the store.
Right. Well, you pay a VAT tax in lieu of a sales tax.
Pardon?
You pay a VAT tax in lieu of a sales tax.
Well, it's not a VAT tax. A VAT tax is a payment on every step of improvement.
Right.
This is a tax on all economic transactions.
But presumably every transaction is done for the purpose of improving the value of something.
Not when you buy stocks and bonds.
Uh-huh.
Why did he rob banks?
Willie Sutton, you're talking about? Yeah, because that's where the money is. Yeah,
where's the money here in transactions?
Yeah. Well, if you just applied this to banks, what you're talking about is the STET tax, the securities transaction excise tax, which we had from the Spanish American War until 1964, and it funded the Securities and Exchange Commission. And
go ahead. Could you please Google the ATP tax.
Sure.
And I think you'll be won over because it is really good. It does away with so every single problem that people bring up about.
I got to tell you, Phil, I will look it up, and I'm very skeptical about any solution that says this solves everything.
Well, it would get rid of the IRS. The only thing the IRS would have to do is see that people follow the law.
Right. But then everybody would become a tax collector. I mean, if
look at every store is a tax collector.
If I get, you know, if I ask Shane to call up and order a pizza for the staff, and I hand him $20, do I pay a tax? Does he pay a tax when the pizza arrives?
Yes.
Both?
Pardon? And they do. They also do.
Yeah. Okay. So we all become tax collectors. I'm starting to see some holes in this, Phil. But let me check it out. Let me check it out. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be back tomorrow. Tomorrow it's Friday. That means Brunch with Bernie, America's Senator. Senator Bernie Sanders talking about all the important issues of the week, taking your calls, plus anything goes Friday, what's on your mind. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually starts with you doing something. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.